Well, I want to start by saying at the outset that tonight and what we're dealing with is actually huge. It's a massively important issue. It's a massive topic that touches very deep things. Why do bad things happen to good people? And if you've come along for this topic, look, I hope it's really helpful for you. Actually, I want to suggest to you in a short time that it'll be quite provocative, but it is huge. It isn't one of those simple, cool, academic topics that you can just sit around and debate and throw back and forward. This has real people with real pain in the midst of it. So at the outset, I do want to say that one answer won't quite fit all. Depending on where you're at tonight, will impact how you receive and hear this. When this question, why do bad things happen to good people, is asked by a family around the bedside, and I was in this context just 2 weeks ago, around the bedside of one of the members of the family who's died, body lying there, when the family around the bedside are asking, why? Why has this happened to us? Why has another child died in our family? Why has another brother died in our family? Why? When the family's sitting around asking the question like that, you engage with those questions very differently than you engage with the philosophical professor who's never had a day of suffering in his life and is just a cynic who's using this as an excuse to avoid things. That man needs to have his bubble pricked, whereas that family sitting around the bedside, they need loads of compassion and buckets of love and great care. The other man can just be using it as a whole game that needs a sharp response. So very different reactions depending on where you're at tonight with this question. You actually might be, and we have amongst us people who have experienced such grief and loss, that you're asking the question from that place. But we have others amongst us too who are asking it from the context of simple academic cynicism that they just want to actually throw and play a game and this is a convenient one. If that's where you're at, well, we'll deal with that a little bit differently. Let me start though by speaking to those of you who might be in pain. One thing is clear is that the God of the Bible, the real God, has himself entered into our world, the world of pain and suffering. He has not remained aloof. The true God, the God you meet in the Bible, has not been distant, simply watching us in our lot, struggling and suffering, and kept his hands clean. One of the extraordinary things about what the Bible presents for us is, and one of the things that compels me to see the reality and the truth of these things too, is that the God who has spoken to us in the Bible has entered into our world in the person of his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. He has come amongst us and lived and dwelt in amongst our pain. He was born as a man. He was born to struggling parents. He lost his father in his youth. It seems almost certain that's the case because the gospel records Joseph disappears from the account. Any engagement that happens later on is between Jesus and the mother, not at all the father. The father's gone. He knew what it is to lose a father. And I know many of you amongst us have felt that pain and grief too. Jesus has been there. He knows that. He was, according to the scriptures, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. He especially knew what it was to be rejected, to have friends dismiss him and push him aside and pay no heed to him and actually betray him. He knew all of that pain. And he knew, of course, the pain of being mocked and tortured. Knowing all of this is powerfully relevant for a number of reasons, but one of the important ones is this: God knows our life. The true God is not distant, he's not aloof, he's entered into your world, he's walked in your shoes. He knows your pain, your grief. There is a wonderful part in the Bible, in one of the Psalms, where the Bible talks about God putting in a bottle every tear that you've cried. And it's a poetic piece of imagery, but the imagery is saying this, that God notices every tear, he takes account of every tear, and he stores up every tear because he's going to bring back for every piece of pain joy and gladness. It won't be forgotten by God. He is a suffering God who ultimately has given himself over to death to pay for us, to rescue us from the world of suffering and grief that we live in. This God is not aloof. He is near to you. He is not far. And so he's a God that you can cast all your anxiety on and put your cares upon because he loves you. Now that's a wonderful message. So in the midst of grief and pain, cling on to that as a firm foundation. There's just a beginning, just some thoughts for you who might actually be coming to this issue from great pain. But let's step back from it as well. I want to actually look at it a little bit more rigorously because there are some big things that do need to be said. Some of these will prick the bubble of the cynic, but they'll also push back against some of us and the way we think about things as well. And I do want to say up front, right at this point, that what I'm going to be drawing attention to tonight is confronting. It is confronting. What I hope will happen for you tonight is that you may come with all these questions about God. How come he? Why is he? What I want to do tonight is turn the whole thing around and let him ask some questions of us. And it will be, I trust, a complete transformation about the way you think of life. It's quite a big claim, and I hope we actually achieve it together tonight. Let me take you through on the basis of four statements. I want to look one statement at a time, four statements, to give you some sense of where we're going. The first one is this. Every religion and worldview struggles with this issue. Every religion and worldview struggles with this issue. It's easy to assume, and some people do assume this, that that religion, they've got the answers. Or that irreligious person, he's got the answers. No, no, no. Every single religion in the world, every single worldview in the world does not have the answers. They think they do. We think we do. But they don't. Think with me about the irreligious person, the atheist. Pick that one. The atheist often imagines that their atheism is the answer to the question of why bad things happen to good people. That is to say, you know, why do innocent people suffer? Why do good people suffer? Well, yes, why do they? How can there be a God if good people suffer? It's so unfair. It means there can't be a God. You remember the famous British entertainer, comedian Stephen Fry. Some of you will be aware of him, seeing him in various contexts. He had a massive rant last year. I know many of you actually chased it up on Google. He had a massive rant last year, and he said these words. He was in the context of being interviewed by on a TV program that kind of does meaning and purpose to life kind of interviews with celebrities, and Stephen Fry was the particular celebrity being interviewed, and he was asked by the interviewer, what would you say to God if you die and you come up to the pearly gates and God is there, what would you say to him? And here's what Stephen Fry said. How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery? There's Stephen Fry's words to God. How dare you create a world where there's such misery? He went on to say, it's utterly evil that you've done this. He then used these words to describe God. He said of God that God is, if God has created a world with suffering, is mean-minded, capricious, and stupid. Now, they are very strong words. You have Stephen Fry, who's effectively dismissed the notion of there being a God because it's so unjust, it's so unfair that suffering exists. We have our own Peter Fitzsimons and other columnists and so on who have come to a similar place on the basis of, if you've seen the suffering I've seen, how can you believe there is a God? Now, some of you actually may have drifted down that direction yourself. Now, each of these men are sure that they've resolved the issue, therefore. Each of them are sure, I've now solved the issue. Why is there suffering in the world? Because there is no God. That's the answer. No. Have a think about the issue a little bit more. Now, we haven't got time to press into all the details, but a moment's reflection on their position shows actually that their answers are very inadequate. They believe they've got the answer, but actually pushing into theirs shows that they're inadequate. Let me give it to you. It's on the basis of a sense of justice that these men throw off the notion of God. That is to say, because they see suffering and the suffering of the innocent as so unfair, it's from their sense of justice and injustice that they believe, therefore, there can't be a God. But think with me for a moment. Where does that sense of injustice come from? How does a person end up with a sense of justice, injustice, right, wrong, truth, false, fair, unfair? How do you end up with those categories of thought? Well, if there is no God, you can't have them. You might have a category of thought that's, I don't like it, we don't like it, we've all agreed together, this is not the way we want it to be. You might have that category of thought within our realm of life together, but you can't reach outside of us and ever claim that there's such a thing as justice over us. You can't have that ultimate objective category called evil, good, truth, wrong, right. You can't have those categories unless there is a God who is over us, who has given those to us. So here's the deal. What you have is a classic case of wanting your cake and wanting to eat it as well. I want to eat it all up, but I want to keep it. And what you end up with is with these men is, I want my cake of justice. I want to have the moral outrage about how unfair suffering is so I can throw God out. But I use the very thing God's given me, moral outrage, to throw God off and end up a world where there is no God, so I can't have moral outrage anymore. But I want to keep my moral outrage so I can throw God away, but end up with a world where you can't have that very thing that's thrown him off. It's just this irrational position in the end. And it's not just me pointing it out. This has been pointed out by philosophers for centuries. We have run this ground many times over as people thinking and living in our world. And it is a great irony that men imagine they've come to an answer when actually you push a little bit further and you see, no, there's great problems in your answer too. Irreligious struggle with it. Religious struggle with it. There is nowhere that's got it sorted out. First thing. Second, actually, I might just reflect on that too. It's important to appreciate that for ourselves. That if you are here wrestling with the things of God, there are deep issues to press into. You do need to think a little harder about what's going on and how it works. And I want to do that with those of us who are religious. So the irreligious, think a little bit harder, press a little bit further, don't settle for easy answers. But it is easy too for those of us who are religious to settle for easy answers. So first statement, all worldviews struggle with the issue of suffering. Second statement I want to unpack with you is it is easy for us to fall for inadequate answers thinking we've got them. And I want to unpack this for you by looking at Luke chapter 13. Now, if you've got your Bibles, turn it up, but if you've got that sheet of paper, you've got the text of Jesus, his words written for you there on that bit of paper, and that will be a great help to look at. Luke chapter 13, the context here is that there was a couple of accidents in the ancient world around the time of Jesus. There was an occasion where religious worshippers were going to the temple seeking to honour their God and so on, and they took sacrifices which they would offer in the temple to God, and in the context of them bringing, you know, going to church, if you like, the ruler at the time, a man called Pilate, as these worshippers came into the temple, he cut their throats. He slit their throats and bled them to death and used their blood as the sacrifice. Now, it was devastating, this news around the ancient world, that people who were just going about their business to actually go to honour God, they got slaughtered doing it. Another accident happened. You see that reference there for you in verse 4, where a tower in Siloam fell on 18 people and killed them. So these accidents were happening in the ancient world, and crowds were asking the question, why? Why did these things happen to these people? Why did these people suffer like this? Now, they come up with their answers. Answers that Jesus says were inadequate. What were their answers? Well, I'll give you the first one. One of the answers that they'd come up with, you get the hint of it from verse 2 there, is that these people who were slaughtered in the temple must have been worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way. That is, they had the appearance of moral good people, but clearly because they were slaughtered, it must have been God's judgment on them for being so evil. So they had their particular view. We call it the divine judgment explanation for suffering. And it goes like this. Why does suffering happen in the world? Well, many people conclude it must be because God is judging their evil behaviour. And the reason some people suffer and others don't, is because some people are more guilty, more evil than other people. The divine judgment view of suffering. You get it also in Buddhism and Hinduism. If you're unaware, Buddhism and Hinduism has a notion called karma. And the notion of karma is you get what you pay for. So if bad stuff happens, it's because I've been bad. If good stuff happens, it's because I've been good. My soul or my spirit attracts to it, if it's corrupted and polluted by evil in me, then it attracts to it bad. If it's a good spirit, it'll attract to it good. A divine judgment view. So if, this is a particular example of a Hindu thinking expressed recently in the UK, where if you've had a disabled child, the Hindu answer to why you're suffering, why your child's suffering, is because of evil adhering to your spirit. You're to blame for the suffering that's come upon you. A divine kind of judgment or cosmic judgment view of suffering. Now, there's a solution people have come to. But look what Jesus says, verse 3. I tell you, no. It is a wrong explanation for why suffering happens. Get that. Jesus says you can get it wrong. And these people got it wrong. He says it wasn't because they were more guilty that they suffered in this way. Now, he doesn't deny that they were guilty, because he appreciates actually the lyrics of that song that we just heard tonight, that there is this darkness inside of all of us. Ultimately, there is no good person. We're all corrupted inside. And so he says, no, it wasn't something terrible happened to you, a good person. They are bad, but no worse than you. Now there he rejects the divine judgment view that says bad things happen to people because they're particularly bad, and if bad things haven't happened to you, it's because you're not bad. He rejects that kind of karma notion. Now again, this person is very important to be corrected in her own thinking. Something terrible one day will happen to you, if it hasn't already. And the temptation will be, either you'll lose a sibling, parents, you get married, a husband, a child, something will happen. And the great temptation will be to think that I must have done something dreadfully wrong to have attracted this judgment upon me. I was with a man who, outside the delivery ward, where his wife had just delivered a child, stillborn. And he was in great grief, sobbing and saying to me, is this because of things I did last year that were so wrong? Is this what's happened to me? God has taken my child because of my sin. And this will be something that comes to you to think through and consider. And Jesus' answer is, it rarely is the case. There are a few occasions where it might be. But suffering is rarely directly corresponding to some particular evil in your life. Jesus doesn't deny that people are sinful and worthy of this judgment, but he certainly rejects the thought that they were more sinful. In Jesus' response, what he does is he keeps forcing people to think things through more deeply. Don't settle for easy answers. Yes, we live in a world that's broken and under God's judgment. We live in a world that has been taken out of the Garden of Eden into a fallenness. And so we live in a world where there is a general judgment of God that's happening, but it's not particularized with a particular sin that God judges directly like that. Jesus, again, dealt with an issue where a man was born blind and people came to him and said, is this man blind because of his sin or his parents' sin? And Jesus says, no, that's an inadequate understanding of why suffering's happening. There's one inadequate answer that religious people often come up with. I'll give you another inadequate answer that religious people often come up with. In a desire to protect God from being to blame for suffering, people say, well, it's not God, it's Satan. God brings nice things. If it's a bad thing, it must be Satan who's brought it. Now, it does protect God. It stops God being to blame, and we don't want that. But the Bible is clear. God rules over Satan, so if Satan does do bad, if he brings suffering into the world, and I believe there is a malevolent spirit, a satanic force, if he does bring evil into the world, he can only do it by the permission of God. You actually get in the book of Job, we'll come back to the book of Job in a moment, but the book of Job has a couple of chapters where Satan does come to, in a poetic expression, but Satan does come to God asking permission to bring some suffering upon a man called Job, and he requires God's permission. Now, if that is the case, even though it might be a satanic work that brings suffering, you've still got God behind it giving permission to it. Why? Why does God give permission to it? We therefore haven't answered the question of why suffering adequately. You see, it's an inadequate thing to explain the problem of suffering by saying it's simply God judging evil people. That doesn't explain all the nuances in that. It's peace, but not all of it. It doesn't answer the question adequately to say it's Satan. God stands over him, and so why does he allow it? And I'll give you another way in which people inadequately answer this problem of suffering. It's the human freedom solution. That is, people are asked, why do seemingly good people suffer? Well, people say in response, well, it's not because God has brought it upon them. We don't want to blame God for that. It's because people brought it upon themselves. And God doesn't want to interfere with human freedom to bring evil into our world. And so he has to let them do it. It's not God's fault, it's people's fault. So a man goes and gets drunk, jumps behind the wheel of the car, drives off and runs over a five-year-old child on the pedestrian crossing, brings great suffering. And you say, why? Why, God? Why has this happened? And the answer for some is, well, God didn't do this. This was the simple evil of a free person who did what they chose and God let them do it. It's human freedom is the answer. Others point out the fact that a lot of human suffering comes because of human evil, and it's the case. Much of our suffering does come because of our poor decision-making. For instance, there's in South America, there's been some dreadful mudslides where whole villages, whole families have been washed down and devastated through these mudslides. And you dig back through and you kind of go, why did God, you know, how come God? Well, people say, no, it was unscrupulous businessmen who developed that whole plot of land knowing it was on a mud-prone slide area, and they built substandard housing and sold it to people who should have known better, and it's actually the evil of the businessmen that caused that all to happen. It's not God at all. Human freedom. But there's two problems with that solution. Though it has much to add, much of the suffering in the world is because of human evil and sin that we perpetrate on each other. But it's inadequate because two things. The Bible still shows that God is able to rule over the human heart and will and direct it without undermining our freedom. He could stop the drunk driver doing what he does without undermining his human freedom in it. Why doesn't he? Why doesn't he? He could have stopped the unscrupulous businessman building. Why? He chooses not to. So you're still left with the question, why? The human freedom thing doesn't solve it for us entirely. It adds a piece, but it doesn't solve it. And you've also got the issue of, is human freedom really worth the cost of untold suffering throughout the world? Let me give you an illustration of this. You're driving down the freeway and you see a family with a bunch of young kids walking down the freeway. I don't know, they're walking to Sydney, they don't own a car or something like this. And they're out for a stroll along the freeway. And one of the kids says to his mother, I want to go to the other side of the road, and I'm going to go to the other side of the road, and starts to run across the road. Now, what does the mother do at that point? What can I do? I don't want to interfere with the child's freedom. How does the newspaper react to that the next day? How does that play? Mother chooses not to interfere with human freedom and let the child do as it chooses, honouring the human freedom, and it gets smashed on a semi-trailer as it runs across the road. That doesn't play well. If I was the mother, I would grab the child by the arm as hard as I could, make bruises on the arm to keep it back. Because interfering with human freedom at that point is worth it, given the cost of leaving them up to their freedom is so devastating. Do you see? So if you think the answer to the problem of suffering is God just wants to let us be free and not be robots, it's an inadequate answer. Doesn't explain the whole picture. So why suffering? Why is God allowing suffering? Especially in a context where some people seem to get a whole lot more than others. Some people see 2-3 family members lost, and others never see a family member lost until they die in their old age. How come some get a whole lot of bad stuff and others don't? How does that, why is that? We have answers that we settle for which make us feel better, but they're very inadequate. So let me take you to the third statement. Why suffering? Why do seemingly good people suffer? Here's the answer. We don't know. We don't know the answer. Glad you came tonight, aren't you? We don't know. We've got some thoughts that we can add in that give a sense of what's going on, but we ultimately don't know the answer. And it's very important that you stick with me and get hold of this, because this is where your whole world turns upside down. We don't know the answer ultimately because we aren't given it by God. He gives us some things to make sense of what's happening in part, but he doesn't give us the whole picture. And he does that to force us to make a choice. Who are you going to trust? And that's the choice that I'm going to put before you tonight. You know, you go back to that ancient book that I mentioned earlier, the book of Job. Let me take you through it very briefly. The book of Job is recorded to tell us about what happened to a man called Job. And humanly speaking, Job, relative to other humans, is a good man. Now, there is no one good, there is no one righteous. In our heart, as the song sang very helpfully for us, there is a brokenness, a corruption that we hide, but it is there. But some can hide it better than others, and some have more to hide than others. Job was one with less to hide than others. He was a good man, relatively speaking. And yet he suffered massively. He lost his house, he lost his business, he lost all his property, he lost all his children and their wives and families, killed, gone. Then he lost his health, and yet he was made to keep his wife. And as you read the book of Job, you realise that was part of the suffering. His wife was a piece of work. Not all wives are a piece of work, but his wife was a particularly difficult woman. And but he was left with this woman who was dreadful. And so you've got this incredible picture of suffering that comes upon this man, this good man. And you, through the book, you're asked this question, why does it happen? Now, he ends up with some religious friends who come and sit with him, and the book records them talking to him about why it happened. They've got the answers, and they tell him why it happened. Basically, they come down to the conclusion, their view is the divine judgment view, which is this could only have happened because you must have sinned badly somewhere, somehow. Bad stuff doesn't happen to good people, and so it must be that you're not good. It must be that you're actually evil and corruption's come upon you. And so they give the divine judgment view and page after page of the divine judgment view. Now come back with me to the book, Job. It's just before the book of Psalms, if you've got a Bible there, because I want to read for you after chapter and chapter of these friends telling Job what the answer is, the Lord God eventually speaks. And he says that your friends have not spoken rightly of me. They've been inadequate in their answers. And then God in chapter 38 gives a series of questions. Listen to this. Listen to these words. Chapter 38, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said, 'This far you may come and no further. Here are the proud waters must halt.' Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of you? Verse 16, have you journeyed to the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Question after question after question. Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of the dew? From the womb, which womb did the ice come? The Lord God questions the man Job, who had been questioning him, and says to him, who do you think you are? You've got no clue about creation. I made the universe. You're just a creature. And through it all, what is astonishing is that not once does God ever say to Job, why? He never explains once why he brought suffering upon Job. It's clear God did, but God never explains why he did it. Do you remember that Luke passage? People come to Jesus with explanations as to why God allowed this suffering, why God brought this suffering. And Jesus says, no, you're wrong. It's not because they're worse sinners. He actually says to them, but unless you repent, you too will perish. You're not better than they are. And if it happened to them, it could happen to you. So repent and turn back to God. But in all of it, again, Jesus doesn't explain why it fell on those people, why those people were killed and not you. He never explains the why. Why did they suffer and not you? He just says, they're no worse, so it happened to them, it could happen to you. You better be right with God. Now, what is going on in all of this? Just this. There is much that we don't know and much that we can't know. And a proper understanding of life and suffering needs to know that there's much that we can't know. You know, typically, suffering and evil is used to deny God's existence. And it's done with this thing called a syllogism. You ready for this? It's done with major premise, minor premise, conclusion. That's how the logic of it all works. And it's done with this thing where it goes, if God were all loving and all powerful, he would have no suffering in his world. There is suffering in his world. Therefore, God can't be all-loving or all-powerful. He can't exist, is the bottom line conclusion for many people. Do you see how it works? If God were a loving God, he wouldn't let suffering happen. Suffering does happen. Therefore, God can't exist, or at last can't be loving or powerful. That's how the little bit of logic goes for many of our friends. But in the midst of all of that, and I need you just to think with me for a second. In the midst of those statements is hidden, not made evident, an assumption that needs to be tested. And the assumption is this, that a loving God would necessarily not have suffering in his world. That's an assumption that people bring to the whole discussion. That if God were loving, he wouldn't have suffering. But that's an assumption. You need to test it. Is it true that a loving God would necessarily never allow suffering? Is that true? I'll give you a story here. You walk into a room. You're in a building. You walk into a room. And as you walk into the room, there's a child there who sees you, a 6, 7, 8-year-old, sees you and rushes over to you, grabbing hold of his arm, screaming and crying in grief and pain, saying, my mother got that man to stab me. And you're horrified because, you know, you're a really enlightened person and you kind of go, you're hurting kids. Where's Docs? Quick, let's get on the phone. Your mother let that happen? That's horrendous. How dare she? And you're comforting this child and thinking to yourself how dreadful the parents are and how could a man ever do that as well? And then the mother says to you, it was an immunization needle. The child needed to have it for a greater good. Do you see the point? A loving mother, in your estimation, you're thinking to yourself, loving mother lets the child suffer? How dare she? Loving parents don't let children suffer? No. Step back and be a little more mature and realise that if there's a greater good to be served by suffering, by pain, a loving parent allows it. even wills it, if it brings about a greater good. Do you see? So the little statement that says a loving God would never allow suffering is wrong. It's naive, it's simplistic, it's superficial. It hasn't understood life and the way it is. When there is a higher good to be gained by suffering, a loving God will allow it, just like a loving parent allows it. You know, when a person says there can't be a loving God because of suffering, what they're saying is this, that there couldn't possibly be a good reason for a loving God to allow suffering. Do you understand the difference? When a person says that a loving God would never allow suffering, what they're really saying is that there couldn't possibly be a good reason for a loving God to allow suffering. Because if there were a good reason, it would be okay. But there couldn't be a good reason, they're saying. But you need to push back on that. Are you sure there couldn't be a good reason? How are you so sure? You who were never there at the creation. You who have got no idea about how the storehouses of storms and how the water and how can you be so sure that there can't be a good reason to allow suffering for a greater good? Sure, you may not be able to think of one, but just because you can't think of a good reason doesn't mean there can't be a good reason. It just means you've got very limited imagination. I can't believe there'd be a good reason. Well, that's a problem with you, isn't it? Christians, you know, often make a mistake in this area. We're too quick to say, here's the answer to suffering. Here's why suffering happens. Human freedom, Satan, judgment. We have all the kinds of things that we trot out. Each of them do add something. They have a piece, but they don't come close to explaining it. And the fact that we've settled for them too quickly means we've got a problem. But skeptics make a massive mistake by insisting there can't be a good reason that a loving God would allow suffering. And it displays their very limited ability to think through the issues. What do we do in the face of suffering? Humble ourselves. Face the fact of your frailty, physically, morally, intellectually. We don't have all the answers to life. We're at the mercy of forces outside of us. Humility is the key piece that we need to add into our lives. Our lives aren't so good that we can rail against God and say, why me? Why did you bring upon this to me? Because we do have a secret life that song sang about that's actually part of who we are. We can't expect of God that we're owed a life of peace and tranquility because we're so good. That's naive. Here's where the divine judgment view has some significant truth to it. You see, Jesus says, were they more evil? No, but unless you repent, something worse will happen to you because you're all equally evil. It's astonishing that you didn't have it happen to you like they had it happen to them. We're not owed anything from God. If you haven't suffered yet, it isn't because you're better. It's part of the mystery of God's providence. Don't be proud. Be careful. Own our frailty. We don't have all the answers. And breed humility in your heart. This is massively important, that we're humble before the Creator. That was the point of the long series of questions in the book of Job. Where were you? Who do you think you are? Whose world is it? Who made the world really? Who runs the world? Who's right? Who has the right over our lives to run our lives? These are actually the bigger questions. Here's where I want to turn it upside down for us tonight. And I think this is where we struggle more than we struggle with suffering. Allowing that there might be someone greater than us that we owe our lives to just pushes all kinds of buttons in us. I won't have someone over me. I won't have someone that I'm at the mercy of. Who does he think he is that he can just do with my life as he pleases? Who's he think he is? God or something? Yes, he is. He is the potter. We're just the clay. Now, I don't know what your reaction is, but I need to know. Well, actually, I don't need to know, but You need to know what your reaction is. Get it out on the table. How are you reacting at the thought that you might just be clay in the hands of the Creator Potter, who has the right to do with you as he pleases? How do you react to that truth? Oh, I won't have that kind of world. Well, whether you'll have it or not doesn't make it exist or not, does it? If that's the way it is, then it's arrogant to assume that it's not the way it is. Dig into how you're reacting to that thinking. Are you outraged that God can take from you and give to you as he pleases? That he can do with his life, with your life as he pleases? Are you outraged by that thought? Get it out in the open, because that is a far deeper issue than the question of suffering. The pride, and I don't know a softer name for it, the pride that won't allow that we are truly creatures under the hand of a creator. The pride that thinks we're much more than that. Call it for what it is. And I want to suggest to you that that's why we're not told the answers. To humble us. To help us come to terms with the fact that we are creatures under the Creator. But you might say, look, my pride, I think, is justified given how many dreadful things God has done in our world or allowed in our world. He's lost all right to have me submit to him and trust him. Really? Where were you when he made the creation? Where were you when he thought about the larger purposes of existence and constructed existence to fit into these greater purposes? Where were you when he did all of that? Are you really that knowledgeable that you know all the possible things that he could or couldn't do and what he can and can't do? Are you really that clever? Are you sure there could be no good reason to allow suffering? Are you so all-knowing? But you're asking me to trust a God without any good reason to trust him. No, 1,000 times no. I'm going to give you lots of good reasons to trust him. But he hasn't told me enough for me to be able to trust him. He's God. He doesn't have to tell you. Well, I won't. Now let me give you what he has given us. He has given us his very own life. He came into our world having seen our pride, the pride that won't have him over us, and instead of destroying us like he ought, instead of taking our life immediately as he ought, he's given you another day of breath. And he has given you the gift of his very own Son, who gave himself up to a cross so that we can be forgiven. God gave up his own child for you, that you might be forgiven. And he waits graciously, patiently for you to come to your senses and come back to him, such as his love. You see, I'm almost finished. God is at one and the same time the powerful God of the universe who owes us nothing, before whom it would be absurd to imagine that we can come and bring our complaints and God feels like he has to answer us. That kind of God isn't worthy of our honour. A God who is at our mercy to have us tell him how he should be. The true God, the God who is worthy of honour, is the one who says, you're just creatures. I'm the creator. I set the rules. That's a God you want to serve, one who is that powerful. Well, just be aware, if he is that powerful, you need to humble yourself before him. But at the same time, he is that God. He's the God of grace and mercy and kindness and generosity, who has entered into our world, though he ought not to have, though he didn't need to, though he had every right to destroy us. He has given his Son's life, such as his love for us, so that you and I might be forgiven. That God of immense power has entered in humility and died for us. You wonder whether you can trust him without him having told you all the answers? Look at the cross. Look how much he's paid for you. Look at how much he's bled and died for you, loving you. If you can't trust him, you can't trust anyone. So what do you do with all of this? Wow, this whole issue turns right around, doesn't it? You kind of get together thinking, let's see if God can justify himself and show that he's not that bad. But what you find is God saying to you, no. God, I'm not in the dock. You're in the dock. You answer my questions. You bow before me. You learn to trust me. This is not about you. That is a total transformation of thinking. We don't have all the answers, but what answers we are given are life-changing, and their questions and they revolve around, will you trust God and let him be God? Will you trust God and let him be God? I'll promise you that when you do, oh, it's life-giving. It builds a rock to live on. I'm now in contact with a God who is immensely powerful that I can be humble before and yet loves me. It's an astonishing life to live. How about I pause there and see if there are any questions? Good on you, Tim.
All right. Well, there's stacks of questions. Very thought-provoking, Andrew. Probably only have time for two, so I'll give you two quickly. If there is a good God, why does he let some evil people live their lives without suffering? You said God can use suffering for good, but why reward evil?
Yeah, there's a psalm in the book of Psalms, Psalm 73, that you would be good to go and read, where the songwriter there actually says exactly this. When I looked at the wicked and the peacefulness they lived in and how they seemed to be rewarded and having life, why did I give myself over to God to serve him when actually I'm groaning all the time and suffering? Well, what he ends up answering is, I looked into eternity and I saw that their state of peace and contentment was just a short time before God will set it all right in a judgment to come. So it's a grace that he has given you. It's a grace that God shakes our lives with suffering to help us see that this world is not where my home is. He breaks me free from the things of this world so that I start to look up and go, what's life actually about? Because my world here is not working. It sucks. It's actually a judgment to leave people without any problems because they can live with the foolish notion that this life is okay, that this can be home and this is all I need to have. No, it's a blessing to be freed from that. That's why the house of mourning is the better place to go rather than the house of praise. Better to go to the funeral than the wedding. Although I'm going to one of those this week, three of those this week, two funerals and a wedding. That's the balance.
Good balance. Bonus question. So
there's a funeral coming. Make sure you kill two people. I don't know how that works, but anyway, there you go.
Is hell real? If so, is it eternal suffering? It seems like God is overreacting for people who don't know that he is real.
Yeah. Yes, hell's real. Yes, it's eternal. Jesus speaks on this and he's quite clear that it's the place where the worm never dies and the fire never goes out. And he speaks with tears in his eyes and says, if anything causes you to go to that place, cut it off. Get rid of it. You do not want to go. So hell is real and serious. He actually dies on a cross to save us from that place. So serious is it. But it does. Is it God overreacting? No. Let me give you some thoughts here. Let's see if we can do this. I'll make this up as a go. If I abuse my friend, that's a bad thing. If I abuse my mother, that's a dreadful thing, given who she is and what she's done for me. If I abuse the queen, I go to prison. Because I'm abusing someone of such importance and significance. If I abuse the God of the universe, the infinite one, I have committed an offence of infinite worth. Our problem is that we just think of offences in terms of relations to people around me, and they seem, you know, I can see there's a gradation of how bad it can be depending on who the person is, but they never really hit much more than 30, 40 years in prison. But that's because our offence is against other humans. You offend against the infinite universal God of the cosmos. That is worthy of condemnation forever. One of the indications too in the Bible is that If you do offend like that and continue to live a life offending like that and cut yourself off from God, then upon his judgment over you of cutting you off from him, giving you what you want, you'll continue in that attitude forever of not wanting him, making it eternally worthy of condemnation. So no, God has not overreacted. You don't want to ask any more questions? I think these are good fun.
Well, I got one more for you. Bonus question.
Bonus question. Okay.
If heaven is...
It's only the... 7:15. Man, we don't finish church until 8:45.
Strap right. yourselves in, everyone. If heaven is the end game and God desires everyone to come to him and it's a place where there's no pain or suffering, why would God not just start us there and skip earth?
Yeah, good question. Okay. The Bible doesn't give us this answer. This is my answer, all right? Why doesn't God just skip us to the end game? I take it, given the cross, given that God bled and died, that there can be no other way to get to the end point where there is a world of eternal peace, no sin ever again, no more tears, death, mourning. I take it the only way to ever get to that end point must be through the cross. Because if there was another way, God would have found it. If he could have got us there without having to have his son die, don't you think he would have found it? So I take it there is no other way to get to that point. Now there's the foundation I lay, and then I'm left going, well, why could that be the only way? Why is that necessarily the only way? I think it is the only way. It must be the only way because of the cross. And one of the answers that people have suggested is the only way to get to a place where I'm not a robot and yet never sin is by having redemption from a sinful history that is forever before me, reminding me of what happens when you sin. What happens when you sin is God has to die and the world has to go through immense suffering. And that history and recollection will be forever before me in heaven, being one of the pieces God uses to keep us from ever sinning again. So I take it that's why he's taken us through this path. But that's a guess, yeah.